Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it. Well, I and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. The sun is shining. It's a beautiful day, and we are live. This is MJ Network, and I'm your host, Fran Lewis, and I am so pumped and excited. We have New York Times author James Heyman here, and we're going to talk about fatal obsession. Images play a vital part within the mind of a deranged serial killer. This guy is really good. Actresses that fit a specific description and a sick attraction with this person's mind as he stalks and follows his prey, justifying his feelings and demanding compliance from his victims. Oh, my God. Sarah Jacobs was his first, and the second was missing was Zoe McKay became his third. And, well, what can I say? I don't know. He might have made a mistake on this one. Handsome and cunning and easing his way into the life, an unsuspected girl, Tyler Bradshaw, one hot guy, caught his victim without breaking a sweat in a way he thought no one would ever find out. And the author is James Heyman, and he is here. Good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing very well, Fran. How are you?
Hanging in there. So,
good.
This was a scary book. And this guy really is out of his mind. And that first scene really grabbed me. In the theater. But how would you define somebody that has a fatal obsession? What would you call that? How would you describe that definition? What is that?
Well, it's a kind of psychopathology. I mean, the guy is a psychopath, but he's a psychopath, becomes one because of injuries he suffered as a child. He was the victim of child abuse at the hands of his father, who constantly smacked him around, hit him, and punched him in the face, and most seriously threw him headfirst into the shallow end of an empty swimming pool where he banged his head against the concrete and suffered a terrible concussion. And all his problems sort of grew out of that incident, and he developed a rage he couldn't control, and he developed a need to follow the obsessions that he developed. And as you mentioned at the beginning, he has an obsession for this young actress, Zoe McCabe. Such an obsession that he watches every single performance of every show she's in and sits in the dark in the audience watching her, planning and waiting for his chance to kidnap her.
Yeah, that was good. So how did you create that first scene? My God. And especially the fight scene between the husband and the wife with him. Oh, my God.
Well, they were sitting in his
seat. That
was
good, really.
They were sitting in his seat. He didn't want them to sit in his seat because he sat in the same seat every night. And it was one of those theaters where you don't get assigned seating. And he was a big guy. He was 6'3", 220 pounds. And he just bullied the hell out of them and finally scared them off. So they changed their seats. And he smugly sat down in the seat he always sat in because it gave him the best view of the actress he was obsessed with.
Well, and he was totally obsessed with poor Zoe. I know that. That was so sad. She didn't even know it.
Oh, she was totally unaware of him.
I know.
She's on stage performing, as it happens, playing Desdemona in Othello in this particular case. And as you and your listeners, I'm sure, all know, Desdemona is the victim of Othello, who, in his own words, loves not wisely but too much. And because he loved this woman too much, he killed her in the play. And that is kind of a parallel theme to what goes on in my story. Our villain, with his obsession, loves Zoe too much. So he's going to take her off and possibly kill her. We'll have to, I'm not going to throw in any spoilers. We'll let the readers find out whether he actually succeeds in killing her or not.
We're not going to tell them.
No,
we wouldn't want anybody to get it. Yeah, well, girls out there, young girls, need to be more careful. Seriously. Somebody
oh,
that
absolutely.
Comes on like him, yeah, it's scary. So we know who Tyler is, and we know he's crazy, and he just never met her. So it's sort of like he forms this whole scene in his mind about how things are going to go. And he
exactly.
doesn't care whether she thinks it or not. And that's scary. And he gets triggered in there. So why does this guy move his seat? I mean, he's so afraid of him? Just because
Tyler threatens to beat the hell out of him, and he's 6'3" and 220 pounds, and the guy is just a little skinny guy, and the guy's girlfriend, convinces him, we don't want to mess around with this guy, let's just move, and let's not get involved in any kind of violence in a public place like this, and they just move. And,
it's amazing that no one from the theater saw that he sits in the same seat every night. Nobody noticed that either, right?
Well, actually, as it turns out, as we go along through the book, we discover that people did notice it and wondered about it, but never occurred to them that he was plotting to kidnap one of the stars of the show. And that was the modus operandi. He always... he would fall for a performer, in one case a ballet dancer, in another case a TV star, and he would watch them and develop this plan about them and eventually carry out the plan, which led to the murder of several, which we know right from the beginning of the book.
That's so scary. So let's go to McCabe and Savage and give us the backstory about them, and we'll talk about how they get involved in this mess afterwards.
Well, McCabe was a New Yorker originally. He, like me, was born in the city. He was born in the Bronx to a family of police officers. His dad was a police officer. His grandfather was a police officer. And so he eventually joined the New York Police Department. And got married, had a child, and was very successful and very good at what he did. He was being promoted up. He was promoted to senior detective level. And then his brother, who was also a New York police officer, was murdered by a drug dealer. And McCabe got involved and took the drug dealer's life legitimately. It wasn't a murder. The guy attacked him first. It was a case of self-defense. But that did not help his future prospects with the NYPD because it was a case he wasn't supposed to be involved in. So he decides, he's a single dad. He's got an 8-year-old at the time daughter. And he decides that as a single dad, it made sense for him to move to a city that would be a better place to bring her up. And he discovers a beautiful small city in northern New England called Portland, Maine, which is where I live. And he moves to Portland, Maine and becomes a member of the Portland, Maine Police Department. And in the first 5 books, most of them take place in Portland. One takes place in northern Maine. Or what they call Down East Maine. And I decided to have McCabe come back to New York. And so at the beginning of the book, his brother calls him and says their mother is dying. This is before Zoe is kidnapped.
Mm-hmm.
And he must come down, you know, so he can say goodbye to his 83-year-old mother who has Alzheimer's. So he and his girlfriend, who's also a Portland cop, Maggie Savage, drive down in the middle of the night because they want to get there before his mother passes away. And they go to the hospital, Montefiore in the Bronx, for those of you who know the city. And she's still alive, and he introduces Maggie to her and tells her that Maggie and he are going to get married. Everybody in the family comes to the hospital to wish Grandma goodbye before she passes, except for Zoe. And so they try to figure out, where is Zoe? And it turns out they discover that in the middle of that night, she has disappeared. And she is McCabe's favorite niece. He loves her dearly. She spent the summer up in Maine at McCabe's summer house. And he cannot go back to Maine until he finds out where she is, what happened to her, and until he punishes the person responsible for the kidnapping. And so that's the story. Can he find her? Can he rescue her before something terrible happens? Or even more terrible happens, I should say.
I know. Well, you know what? Alzheimer's, my mother had Alzheimer's. And, yeah, it was horrible. And
it's a dreadful disease.
It's the disease that they're never going to cure, ever. Maybe they'll find something that'll slow it down, but they're not going to cure it. And they still haven't figured out what the cause is. It's scary. And to the day she died, she knew who I was. She knew everybody was. But it's like her mind goes, and she knew she had it from 2003 on. It's horrible, and she drove me crazy for 8 years, but I took care of her. So
it's a horrible
disease.
It's Rose McCabe. McCabe's mother had it.
Yeah.
And, was your mother's name Rose?
Ruthie. But you know what? When I wrote my book, when I wrote my Bertha Fights, my Bertha Fights Back, and my Bertha Stories, I changed her name to Rosie, and I made her my grandmother. Yeah, my mother's name was Ruthie. She was a force to be reckoned with, and you never know what you never know what they're going to say. You should only know what she used to call me when I walked through the door. My God.
And who are you? Oh, I know who you are.
She would say to
I've...
me, you look like a you-know-what. I don't like what you're wearing. You're a hooky hooker or something? I go, Ma, you got my profession. I'm really impressed with you today.
It's a horrible disease. Yeah.
But you know
thank God I didn't have to live through that personally.
You don't want to. But you see, there's too few support services to keep her alive, and she did not have a DNR. Neither did my mother, because I wouldn't allow them. And her doctor wanted me to have a DNR. I said, you pull your own. So who is Fran and who is Bobby? What happens when McCabe sees them?
When McCabe sees his mother?
No, the other people that are there. Who else was there that came to the
hospital brother,
and his family? Yeah.
His brother, Bobby, and Bobby's wife. His brother Bobby is a lawyer, a personal injury lawyer in New York, and Bobby's wife is a woman named Kathy. She's the second wife, not the mother of Zoe, but stepmother of Zoe. And McCabe's sister, who is a Catholic nun, who has made a vow of poverty, but she's a very faithful Catholic, and McCabe's mother is an immigrant from Ireland. She came across when she was 17 years old and moved in with an uncle in the Bronx. And this, we tell this story actually in the book very briefly, but she met McCabe's father at a dance, and he was a policeman. He said, well, I can't let you walk home alone. I'm a cop. It's my duty to walk you home. And when he brought her to her door, he kissed her goodnight and asked her if he could see her again. And soon thereafter, they were married. And the four McCabe children were born. My hero, Mike McCabe, is the youngest of the four. And we got to know each of them in turn, although one had been murdered, as I said, by a drug dealer, crazed drug dealer.
Scary. I grew up in the Bronx, in the South Bronx.
In South Bronx?
Yeah, Southern Boulevard in Tremont.
Yeah.
Not exactly the best area, but I loved it. It didn't bother me. And Montefiore Hospital? I know exactly where.
Definitely. No, I know where it is, too. I mean, I was born in Brooklyn, and we moved out when I was about 6 or 7 years old. My parents wanted to try the suburbs, so they moved to a place called Roslyn in Long Island.
I know
stayed there for 2 or 3 years. Didn't like that very much, so they tried New Jersey. They moved to a place near Red Bank, New Jersey. Didn't like that very much, so they moved back to Manhattan when I was like 10. And so I was really raised in Manhattan. And
New York people.
But
the
I'm
best
a New Yorker.
Yeah.
moved to Portland. I moved to Portland in 2001, just before the 9/11 attacks. You know, culturally and socially, sociologically, I'm a New Yorker. I know the city. I love the city. I worked there in the ad business for, I think it was 37 years, if I count it all up.
Wow.
For different ad agencies. And there was a creative director. I had a lot of fun.
Oh, nice. That is nice.
Yeah, the ad business is a great business, and it trains you to be a good writer. Actually, if that's what you do in advertising, is to become
this
a
is very true.
Or a creative director. You mentioned Stuart Woods. Stuart Woods worked for the same ad agency I worked for, Young and
Really, American. Really?
Yeah.
I get his books without even asking. Katie Grinch just sends them, and I've got
right.
a whole new one inside. I read them in 10 minutes. I love his books. I mean, Stone Barrington.
Yeah.
Boy, the stamina of that guy, let me tell you.
Another ex-ad man, of course, is James Patterson, who was the president of a big agency
really?
Called J. Walter Thompson until he decided he'd done enough advertising and wanted to write thrillers. And he started doing the... well, he's a tough one to get on the show. Everybody wants him on,
yeah.
I'm sure. I mean, I'd guess. I would guess. I don't know for sure, but I would on selling, even though he has all these helpers write the books.
Tell me about it. I just read two.
Yeah.
He wrote Target Alex Quest by himself. That was
well, he
writes
some of them by himself. I think he likes writing the Alex Cross books by himself, but I know some of his co-writers.
Yeah.
Maxine Petro used to work at the agency I worked at, and she's written a bunch of books with him. And
this one was written by James O'Born, and it was called Ambush.
That one I don't know.
I just finished it.
He has too many books. I can't keep up with him. He publishes, 20 books a year or something? I mean, it's crazy.
I think he's coming out with another 5 in the next 3 weeks or something. So I just emailed his publicist. I said, keep them coming because I want to read them. So,
yeah. Well, that's great.
We have Tyler and Zoe. Now, girls, when you go to a bar, be careful. The other thing I even taught my nieces, because they're in their 20s, when you go to a bar and you leave your drink, spill it out and don't drink it because you never know somebody's going to put something in it, as some people learn the hard way. So Tyler meets her in a bar. How does he sort of convince her and accompany her home? That's scary.
Well, actually, he doesn't. He sees her in the bar.
Yes, he's in the bar,
and he stares
yeah.
at her because he can't take his eyes off of her whenever he sees her. And she
scary.
Notices him. And notices that he's a little strange looking.
yeah.
But she's with another guy, so she feels comfortable. And the other guy says, don't worry about him. He's just, you're such a beautiful woman that guys look at you, so just don't worry about him. And they have their meal, and they leave the bar, and they're talking. And the guy she's with offers to walk her home, but it's the Lower East Side of Manhattan. There's plenty of people walking in the street. It's not that late. And she only lives a couple blocks away, so she convinces him that she's fine. And he reluctantly lets her walk home alone. Of course, unknown to her, she is followed by Tyler Bradshaw, who is the one who is obsessed by her. And he can be very, very charming. And he had arranged, unknown to the reader until this point, had arranged to meet her at the first night party for the Othello production. He had crashed that party and said hello to her, but she barely remembered him. But she remembered him well enough to know that she had met him once, so she allowed him to chat, and he was very charming, and he walked her home. And when they get to her door, she unlocks the front door of the tenement she lives in. He pushes his way in, and the rest, as they say, is history.
And then somebody gets killed. Annie, oh, I felt so bad.
Yeah, one of the neighbors sees him.
She saw too much.
One of the neighbors came home just at the wrong time. Bradshaw's at the elevator carrying out some of Zoe's things because he's going to take some of her clothes and some of her possessions up to his secret hideaway. And this woman, Annie, walks out of Zoe's next door neighbor walks out of the elevator just at the wrong time. And Bradshaw figures she can identify him. She's a potential witness. So he sadly kills her and stows her body in a closet in her apartment and tapes it up, hoping that the smell of a decomposing body won't be noticed or won't escape. But, of course, the police discover Annie's body, and that's part of the clues that lead them eventually to get Bradshaw.
Well, I got nervous throughout the book because I was worried about Zoe, but Zoe's pretty smart, though.
Zoe's very smart. She was not a helpless. She was not a helpless victim by any by any means at all. She was planning and plotting and using her skills as an actress to keep him confused and interested and to keep him basically from killing her. And it was sort of like, if you remember the old story of Scheherazade, The Thousand and One Nights, where the woman tells the king stories every night to keep him interested and to keep him from killing her, as the king had killed so many women before. And Zoe even thinks of that, but she knows that she has to fascinate Bradshaw and make him interested and keep him interested and keep him from wanting to kill her, because she's going to be such an interesting person that she wants him to want her alive. And so she plays him very cleverly for quite a while. And I'm going to let readers discover how that turns out. But
well, we're not going to tell them, but Cheryl is listening, and she just emailed me. She wants to read this. Hint, hint. Hint, hint.
Well, I hope
she
Cheryl
wants
enjoys
she,
it.
Cheryl, yeah, she wants to read this. She should. She, you know, really, you got to read this, people. So there's a homeless guy, and tell us about why doesn't he realize that Zoe's in trouble? And he sees her, but, like, he discounts it. He doesn't see.
Well, he doesn't know she's in trouble. She's with a guy. He's
yeah,
lying there.
Know, yeah.
He's, you know, wrapped up in basically in rags and plastic bags, as so many homeless people end up in New York. And he's always, you know, sleeping next to the stairs up to Zoe's apartment. And she actually gives him $5 while she's on the way home. But he sees Bradshaw, but Bradshaw thinks about killing him and decides that's not a smart thing to do, so he lets him live. And the homeless guy gets a good look at his face. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that becomes sort of a minor offshoot of the story, but he becomes sort of a witness in the story. Not that his witnessing the guy's face leads the cops to him, but it's another clue in a long string of clues that they put together.
Well, until they figure it out, and if they ever find where she is, because it's not going to be that easy to find her where he took her. So
he takes her way the hell out in a very secret place.
In Hangamanga land, nowhere. So what does he drug her? And he gets agitated. And poor Zoe. You want to smack this guy in the head. So why does he drug her? Does that make it easier for him to just get away?
Makes it much easier.
Go?
He gives her a couple of drugs that will induce, put her out, basically. Actually, I got the names of the drugs from a nurse anesthetist who's a friend of mine. She said these would be the perfect drugs.
Nice.
And so she's out. I mean, it makes it very easy for him to. What he does, you know, since you've read it, he rolls her up in a rug from her apartment and just throws her in the back of his car. And as far as anybody knows, it's just a rug he's putting in the back of his car. And he drives off to the secret place. And she's dead to the world. I mean, she's out. She, you know, has no idea where she is. She does wake up just before they arrive at the house. But she is totally out of it. She's like a surgery patient.
And we've all been there at one time or another.
Yeah, we have. In fact, I was there recently. I just had hip replacement surgery about 3 months ago.
Oh God!
It was basically a piece of cake. What's
that?
Yeah,
that's good. That's just so much fun. I know.
Well, it hurt like hell before I had the surgery because there was absolutely nothing but bone in the hip socket, and it was rubbing against it. And just it was advanced osteoarthritis, which is usually the reason they give you the hip replacement surgery. But the operation itself was, well, I wasn't aware of what they were doing, obviously, because I was out.
Mm-hmm.
But they let you out of the hospital after one day, make you climb a flight of stairs before they let you go. And the recovery is pretty quick. It's a pretty amazing procedure for anybody who's having osteoarthritis in their hip joints. Don't be afraid of getting hip replacement surgery because it's really one heck of a successful procedure.
I'm trying to avoid all of that and then some. No, my last one was gallbladder, and they put me out at 7:40. I was up at 8:15, and I said, "What can I eat?"
Oh, that's good.
It was not bad.
Anything.
Yeah, I went home the same day. I couldn't wait to go home, and then I took a walk the next day. They said, "You're supposed to stay home for a week." I said, "No, not going to happen."
Okay.
So yeah, that was the joy of my life. So where does he live? Tell us about the Stanford home and how this guy lives. I mean, really, you would have think it was a home that everybody would want, but he's out of his mind.
It's a country house. It was his parents
yeah.
and grandparents' country house. He came from a very rich family, and they had this big house in basically what was northern Connecticut, sort of in Litchfield County, but it was sort of out all by itself. They owned like 20 or 30 acres. Nobody could see the house from the road. And nobody was aware that there was anything wrong there. I mean, it was sort of a secret place. It was quite the mansion. Actually, I based on a house that I have seen and been a guest in that is in that same area, a house owned by a friend of mine and who happens to have a lot of money. And so I use that as the basis of the location. Mm-hmm. I often do that mm-hmm. in my books. I use locations that I've either visited or seen personally. And for houses, I do that a lot. The other way I find a house in a place I've never been is to go to Realtor.com and do a virtual tour of houses on sale. So I can describe all the rooms perfectly. And,
That is clever. That is clever. I should try that if I ever get 5 minutes to finish the next one I'm writing.
I'm
actually very proud of myself. I finished 2.5 stories. I'm so excited, finally.
Congratulations.
Please. I just have to hope I get my facts right and who I'm going to kill off and put behind the gravestone. I tell it from the point of view of the dead body behind the gravestone, what they did wrong or why somebody did something wrong to them. And it's fun.
It sounds like fun.
It sounds as if you have anybody
let
don't
me know
like,
when you
let
fit,
me know.
Let me know when it's ready to be read.
I will. As a matter of fact, I might ask you to read it so I don't mess up.
Okay.
I love people to read it first so that I get an idea of what I need to fix.
Absolutely. Every writer I know has some people they depend on to read their work.
Mm-hmm.
Usually the first complete polished manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my agent obviously is one of my first readers, but I have some friends who are novelists, not necessarily mystery writers,
mm-hmm.
but who read my stuff, and it's great. They make good suggestions. So
that is good because I'm going to ask you to do that, and maybe one or two other people. But this is different. Anyway, while she's hoping to live and deals with Tyler, how does McKay form a task force to find her?
Well, as I told you, he was for a long time on the New York NYPD, and he has a lot of friends who are on the NYPD,
mm-hmm.
including the chief of detectives, who he knew when he wasn't chief of detectives. But he asks him to let him help work on this case with them, and because he's good buddies with the chief of detectives, he makes it happen. That might not happen in real life, but I think I make it believable in the book. And so he works on the case. And,
well, I could see McCabe would have worked on it anyway, and he wouldn't care if he got caught or got in trouble. He just would have done it no matter what.
He would have done it no matter what, but he figured he figured better to work with the police department with all the resources they have than to try to solve it by himself. Actually, I debated that a little bit before I wrote it, but it allowed me to bring back some of McCabe's NYPD experiences and insert them into the book. So it was good background for readers about his past.
Well,
there are a lot of readers who really like the character and want to know about his past, so this was a good opportunity to stick some detail in and make it, you know, feel like it's coming naturally rather than just sticking it in.
That's why you have to write another one, because I like this character, and there's so few authors whose books I like the characters lately, seriously.
Well, thank you. I'm very fond of them. I think readers really do enjoy Maggie and McCabe. I can't tell you how many emails I get. And the first thing they say is, I love Maggie and McCabe. They're a great pair. I just love reading their story and about their relationship and the fact that they work together as detectives. And so I will not be dropping them by any means. I am writing, as I think I said, I'm trying a standalone, a totally different kind of story. It's still a mystery and murder story, but different from anything I've done with the McCabe Savage series.
Of course, after that, I'll come back.
What's that?
Of course, I'm going to want to read it, naturally.
Well, I hope you do, obviously. That'll be terrific.
So tell us about Randall and how they learn about the problem at the theater, because no one really knew about it, and finally they get this information and they go to the theater and they find out, well, this is what happened.
Yeah. Well, Randall Carter is the guy who plays Othello. That's who you mean, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell you about him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he is he's a well-known actor, very successful both on Broadway and Hollywood. And he's a black actor, which is usually they cast a black actor in the role of Othello because he was supposed to be from North Africa. And he puts on this production in a small community theater down on the Lower East Side as sort of a practice session to see, to perfect the production of Othello, with plans to bring it up to Lincoln Center at the Vivian Beaumont Theater. And he's very impressed with the young actress that he cast in the role of Desdemona, which is obviously the key female role in Othello. He casts Zoe in that role, and she does a terrific job, and he wants her to come up uptown. When he brings the production uptown, he wants her to continue playing the role of Desdemona at the Vivian Beaumont, but he's also kind of flirting with her. I think she's kind of an attractive woman. She's a beautiful woman. So he's kind of interested, and he becomes briefly a suspect. But he also becomes a witness because he's one of the few people who actually noticed this guy coming to the theater night after night after night. Didn't think too much of it at the time, but when Zoe disappears, it clicks in his head, and so he's able to provide the police with at least sort of a description. I mean, he didn't get a great look at him because the guy was sitting in the audience and was only partially lit by the stage lights, but he still gives some kind of description of who he thinks the bad guy might be.
How did they find the guy that Mooney and his girlfriend, and did they help at all? The guy that was sitting in the seat that he almost pulverized.
Yeah, they do help. They talk to the manager of the theater, and it turns out the guy they almost pulverized complained to the manager of the theater about the fact that they were almost pulverized. And so she gives McCabe Mooney's name, and he calls him in as a witness, and he provides a physical description of the guy who threatened him, who they're pretty sure is the bad guy. And so they get a good sketch of who, you know, Tyler Bradshaw. They know what he looks like. They just don't know where the hell he is or where he's taken Zoe. And whether they can get there before, you know, something terrible happens. It's a sort of a race against the clock because they're sure something bad will happen. Previous victims of this guy, he kept around for about a week before he finally decided he'd had enough of them and committed murder.
And then he goes on to the next one. But before I forget, Monday, Patricia Hale will be here with Scar Tissue. And on Wednesday, award-winning author, USA award-winning author John Land, Manuscript for Murder, Jessica Fletcher Murders. On the 12th, I'm doing something different. The author's name is, I don't know his real name. Seriously, his name is I Am Waiting, and it's In My Mother's Honor, and he's a new Vietnam vet. I'm doing it on Veterans Day. He never got his benefits, and he's in his 70s, and we're going to talk about his journey. On November 14th, the one and only Tess Gerrinson is giving me an exclusive interview. I'm so excited. On her horror movie that I have to watch, Island Zero. On the 20th, New York Times author Vincent Zandri, Flowerman. On the 26th, a retired DEA and SWAT team detective, Bo Wagner, Network Exposed. And on the 28th, to end November, Artie Van Wy will be here with 9/11. He's a 9/11 survivor. So that's just November. Wait till you see what's going to happen in December. It gets even better. So what does he do? What happens at the station that's odd? What happens at the police station? And what happens when a Mountie falls over the killer? That's so weird.
I'm sorry. Tell me again, what was the question?
What happens when a Mountie accidentally falls over the killer, like the horse?
Well, he's right. It's a Central Park New York mounted cop. He's on his horse, and he sees a guy. I don't really want to get too much into this because it will provide spoilers. Sees a guy who he suspects of being the murderer. Is he the murderer? We'll find out. Or I'll let the readers find out.
Okay, well,
telling you will be too much of a spoiler.
Yeah. Oh, okay, we're going to cross out the next one too.
I mean, I don't think you want me to tell your listeners who did what and when they did it and how the story ends. And there won't be any reason for them to read the book.
No. Cheryl, you got to read this seriously. You won't be. You're not going to be able to put it down. And I got eye strain that day too. Can I say? So, how come Zoe is able to endure everything that this monster does, and she doesn't let up? And she doesn't know that McCabe might be able to find her.
Now, she thinks he's going to kill her in the end, but she's going to She's going to damn well do everything she can to kill him before he kills her. And that's really what her goal is in captivity, to find a way. And she does, as you know, and as readers will find, does manage to injure him once or twice. But he's not quite ready to kill her yet, because that's part of the relationship between the two of them that I think makes the story very interesting. They develop a genuine relationship. I mean, it's a weird relationship and a crazy relationship. But he doesn't want to kill her because she is successful in making their being together so interesting for him, even though she does manage to injure him once. So, again, I think the heart of that book is Zoe's cleverness at staying alive and playing this guy who's no dummy. I mean, he's not, you know, your big brute. He's a smart guy who just has a brain deficiency, a brain problem. He's a smart guy who believes that he's totally in love. He is obsessed with this beautiful young actress. And it's sort of a match between them that they're trying. It's sort of a dance to the death, if you will. She plays him, and he tries to play her off against herself. So it's they're pretty well matched. She's, you know, 5'3" and weighs 115 pounds. He's 6'3" and weighs 220. It's not a physical match.
Oh,
but she's a brilliant young woman, and she's very clever mm-hmm. in the way she handles him, and plays on his ego, and I think that's really the heart of the book.
I agree with you, but you know, I'm short and I weigh 111 pounds now. I'm skinny. And we're, you know, short people, you got to watch out for us. We're really smart.
Exactly. Well, Zoe, you had to watch out for Zoe because
she
was pretty tough.
Very
and she came
tough.
Up. Yeah. And she, like you, was born in the Bronx.
I know. This is why we emulate. Yeah, I taught in the Bronx for 36 years in a very tough school. And I was assistant to
part of the public school system.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would walk into the classroom, and they would go, "She's here. Just do what she says. It's much easier." And yeah, as little as I am, there's like I could say something, and somebody else 9 feet tall could say something, and she just said that. Just don't even get her angry. It would not be good because my rewards were so much better. I mean, seriously. I had to do lunch duty. I had 25 classes, and I made a big mistake by saying to them, if no one gets in trouble the whole month, I will bring treats for everyone. Lo and behold, 25 classes, no one got in trouble.
Well.
Next time that was scary. I had to carry 50 boxes of cookies so that everybody would get two for the whole class. Next time I realized.
You could have hired somebody to carry them for you. Well, not on a teacher's salary, I guess. But,
well, no, they were a riot. So explain, how does McKay realize, tie it together, and tell us, well, we know that Tyler is out of his mind, but what does he actually, to Zoe, that we wouldn't expect that he would say to her? He's really
because he's out of his mind and because he's madly in love with her.
Yeah, I know. He's, you know, you get people like that in this world. It's scary. So,
yeah.
How would a psychiatrist, you know, define him as besides psychologically delusional and deranged and looking at
well,
the world
there is
and,
actually,
like nobody else does?
If there is actually a disease, mm-hmm. the initials are CTE, and it's chronic traumatic, and I can't pronounce the E word, but it's cephalopathy or something like
gotcha.
That. And it's what professional football players get from having too
mm-hmm.
many concussions. It's also what veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been getting as a result of being near what they call IEDs, explosive
mm-hmm.
devices, which rattle their brains. And the rattle brain develops this disease, which causes uncontrollable rage, which Tyler Bradshaw
mm.
has in the book. And in real life, you can take an example that it does lead to people murdering other people.
Mm-hmm.
The Boston Patriots football player, Aaron Hernandez,
mm-hmm.
who murdered, I think, 3 people and then committed suicide in the jail cell, suffered from this disease. And when they did the autopsy of his brain, they said it was the most advanced case. He was only 27 years old. They said
the
most advanced case that they had ever seen in anyone so young. He had taken so many hits to the head that his brain was damaged to a very massive extent, which causes the kind of rage and obsessiveness that we see in Tyler Bradshaw, who also suffered a lot of concussions when he was a kid, from his father beating him and then throwing him into the swimming pool, as I said, where he landed on his head against the concrete.
So I wonder what would happen if somebody like that was actually alive and arrested. Would they put him in jail or would they put him in a mental institution? Because basically it's his fault, but it's not his fault. He couldn't help himself.
They put Hernandez in jail for his murders,
yeah.
Not knowing the state of his the damage that had been done to his brain, and it really never occurred to them to. You can't check it out with the person who's alive, because you have to autopsy the brain, and
that's scary.
So he was going through the justice system. He was declared guilty of murder. I think he got a life sentence, Hernandez. And after he killed himself, they did the autopsy and discovered that he had a very advanced case of this disease that a lot of the professional football players are getting. I think it's a reason a lot of parents aren't allowing their kids to play football these days. Got to be very careful. I mean, that's very damaging.
I know. That's scary. I have a 12-year-old nephew that plays football on Thursdays and Fridays, and I worry.
Well, you got to worry. Like, and
I know. He does. And I said, and his father's the coach. I go, like, you know, you better be careful, Cade, because you don't want to hit your head or anything like that. And supposedly he's good. But there's another element that we didn't bring out, and we've got about 15 minutes. What happens in the Alzheimer's care center that shows that they're not exactly the best care center in the world? What happens to Rose that, I mean, if my mother was home, I wouldn't put her in a care center like that, ever. So what happens, knowing what happened to Rose, is it possible, why didn't they do something about it? And it's really sad because I got upset with that one.
Yeah, well, she was in this care center. It was not an inexpensive care center either. It was a memory treatment place called the Willows up in Westchester County.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow she got out of her room. They had, you know, a lock on the door that needed a numbered code to unlock. Couldn't just turn a lock handle or anything like that. It needed the number code to get out. Somehow, and I explain it as the fact that she was a lifelong piano player, as finger memory. She had watched the nurses and attendants use this code over and over and over for the 3 years that she'd been in this place, and her fingers remembered the movement of their fingers, which I don't know if it's actually possible, but I believe from what I've read about Alzheimer's that finger memory like that, particularly for somebody who was good at playing the piano or using their fingers sequentially like that, would definitely be possible. So that's what I did in the book. I can't say it was the facility's fault. Who could know that she would be able to go through the number code that unlocked the door? But she did, and then one of the people who worked at the place tried to call to her and catch her, but she ran off and opened a door and fell down a flight of concrete steps, which caused severe concussion in her case, and eventually led to her death. It wasn't the Alzheimer's that actually killed her. It was the concussion and the injury to her brain.
No, I do understand that. My mom was home, and I once got a call from an aide, and she said, "Your mother's not here." I said, "Now, how could that happen? The door is locked up on top." It seemed that before the aide got there, she got out to went to a bakery by herself. And I had to change the locks and make a chain and whatever the heck on it was. And I said to the aide, "How did you get in there?" I was wondering, like, how did you get in if the door's closed anyway? My mom said to me, "I went to the bakery because I wanted bread because no one feeds me." I go, "What?" And then she took a ride from somebody that she didn't know. She said, "I know him." I said, "You're not doing that again." And I said,
"It turned out the person who gave her the ride was okay.
I don't know who. I never found out who it was. Whoever it was just dropped her by the building, and she knew where she lived. And obviously, she left her key, so she asked the neighbor to let her in with their key. And I said, at this point, it was getting really bad, and I had to get rid of the aide. I didn't trust her. So we had to put a chain all the way at the top of the door, hoping that she didn't climb up. Her other thing was trying to find her car keys so that she could, you know, drive. I go, like, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And we had a high, well, if I tell you, it was an experience at Comedy Center. So tell us more about Maggie and McCabe and how their relationship changed throughout this book, because it got good at the end, I think.
Well, their relationship is of, in the first book, The Cutting, which I think you've read, you said you've read.
I loved it.
They really are just people who work together. They're partners. They're both detectives with the Portland Police Department. Maggie, as I may have mentioned, I'm not sure if I did, is a Maine born and bred young woman. She was born up in Machias in Washington County, which is about as far east in the United States as you could possibly get. It's what they call down east in Maine. And she works with McCabe. She kind of has a crush on him, and he has a crush on her in the beginning books. But he's living with a woman who he loves and who loves him, who's an artist, in the first couple of books. So they keep their distance. As she says to him, I think in the first book, nothing is going to come of our relationship because you're taken. You have this girlfriend you're living with and who I think you love. And that's where the relationship begins, but it slowly develops. And by the fourth book, McCabe is breaking up with the woman he lives with, the artist, who leaves and moves to San Francisco. By this time, they're sort of dancing around the idea of beginning a relationship between the two of them, but they really don't. And because they both work together, they're detectives, they're partners of the Portland Police Department. So really, it's not something they can do easily, or if at all. The department certainly wouldn't welcome her working, technically working for him as a detective and being in a relationship with him. I mean, they simply wouldn't allow it. They might allow them to get married, but if they did allow them to get married, she'd have to work in a different division, or he'd have to work in a different division. They could no longer work together if they were married. That would be against the rules, which I've checked out, actually. And the relationship develops, and they have sort of a secret relationship by the time this sixth book comes along. We learn a lot about that relationship in book number six. And I'm not going to, again, no spoilers allowed.
No, no spoilers allowed. And we're not going to tell anybody whether they find Zoe or not. But in real life, in reality, how would somebody, after going through all this, survive? How would they be stable afterwards?
It depends how tough they are, I think. I mean, you know, people go through all kinds of hell. Some people manage to survive and others don't. I mean, the most obvious example is people who come out of various wars. I mean, these days we call it PTSD. Yeah. 100 years ago in World War I, they called it shell shock because they had no idea what it was. And before that, they just accused people of cowardice, not realizing that it was a physically caused illness. They thought they were just acting weird and cowardly back in the days of the Crimean War and the Civil War in this country.
Well, before we end, I want to read the end of my review, people. Fear escalated as a killer holds all the cards, and author James Hammond strikes a high note that reverberates real loud as the psychological mystery thriller comes to a dramatic and heart-stopping close. Will Zoe be saved? I'll never tell you that. If she will she remain on stage? Lives are in danger, and one is hanging by a loose thread because of one man's fatal obsession. McCabe and Savage are at their best, and Zoe, to me, you need to bring her back as a new star. And that is my ending of your review. And it's I said, I got to figure out a way to end it with the title. So before we close, where can everybody learn more about you and your work?
Well, they can learn a lot at my website, which is jameshaymanthrillers.com. They can also find me on my Facebook page, which is called James Hayman's Murderous Mind. Places like Amazon have obviously author pages, which will give a biography and show a picture of my gorgeously handsome face right there. And
you are.
Well, that's very nice of you. And those are probably the best places, unless they happen to run into me at one of those wonderful crime conferences that you and I met at. I think we met at Thriller Fest last year, wasn't it?
Because I walked up to Bruce Coffin and I said, "Hi, this is me, and I'd love to do it." And go, like, "How come I never read your book?"
Right.
I was like, I know my husband just looks at me as if, you know, why do you do that? I go, that's, my mother would do that. She used to do that all the time. You know, like, just go up and ask the question and don't be afraid to say anything. And, well, why not? So I'm glad I did.
I'm glad you did as well. And I think that's the right way to do it. We go to these conferences to meet people and to hopefully form some kind of relationship with them, or, as in our case, have me appear on your radio show, which I thoroughly enjoy, and hope to someday do it again.
You definitely will as soon as you come out with another one, or send me something else to read to add to my pile of, it's so high up over there. I know some people, I received several books yesterday. I hope those people don't mind. It's going to take me a very long time to read them. But,
well, you're one of the fastest readers I know, but still, you have a heck of a lot of books to read.
I do, but in December, I am going to interview, I couldn't believe this, I was like, oh my God, Stephen James agreed to be with my show, the last show of December of the new of the, this year, Every Wicked Man, and we're going to announce the 2018 Just Reviews. That's me, people, not Kirkus, not MDIP, but Just Reviews Books of the Year. I will announce it that day, and everybody that gets one will get their surprise. And I'm not telling Co. I cannot kill that. I do that
okay.
Every year, and I trick people, and they have no idea what I'm doing. But I want to thank you so much. Are you coming to the Thriller Fest next year? Are you going to be there?
I'm planning to be there, yes. So I hope to see you again there and get a chance to say hi in person.
If they invite me and they tell me they want me there, you can bet I'm going to be there, because it's like a vacation and I relax. But I want to thank you so much, everybody. It's a beautiful day. Cheryl, you want to read this seriously from the beginning. If you send me the beginning ones, I'll read them too. Everybody have a nice day. And thank you, James, and bye.
Thank you, Fran. It was a pleasure.